Have you ever heard yourself speak or watched yourself, a more recent incarnation of yourself, on video? It's profoundly uncomfortable and disorienting. The worst assignment that I ever had in seminary was not writing long papers. It was not ancient Greek. It was not ancient Hebrew. It was in preaching class, where the procedure was you simply had to be videotaped giving a sermon. And then you had to go home and you had to sit down and you had to watch it all the way through from the beginning. And I'll tell you what, seeing yourself through somebody else's eyes is a profoundly disorienting thing. I picked up on all sorts of mannerisms that I had that I didn't know I had. Apparently, I say the bottom line is all the time. There's like 12 bottom lines in every sermon. And you guys are all like, what's the bottom line? I don't know. You know, like you get all these ticks. You know, I realized how much you go back and forward and walk around side to side. Like seeing yourself through other people's eyes is really disorienting. You think you're somebody, and then you see yourself as other people see you, and you're somebody else entirely. You know, like, who am I underneath all of that? Whose vision of me is the primary one? We are actually social creatures. Other people's presence makes us who we are. If you're in one of our parish groups, you know that this past week we did genograms. We looked at our family histories. And we talked about how God's faithfulness down through our families has shaped who we are today, and how our own faithlessness to him has shaped us down through these days. And one of the things that in our group, without sharing any secrets, we found this common thread that all of our grandparents had some experience in World War II. And that had shaped them down through the generations so that like parts of our personality that we think are just distinctly us because we're individuals who can discern our own identities are actually given to us or bestowed upon us by other people, not just people in the present, but people in the past. That's how it works. Other people make you. They make your identity. And that's not actually that bad of a thing. You know this yourself around certain friends. Certain friends bring out aspects of your personality that do not come out around other friends. Isn't that true? You've got your fun friends. You got the ones that you go to when things are hard. You got your ones that you go to for wisdom. You got your ones that you go to for a party. All these different sorts of people. And there's overlap. The best friends overlap in lots of those ways. But different people bring out different things in us at different times. We are socially constructed people. Other people make us us. That's how it is. I remember realizing this particularly when I was getting a haircut. And I saw how the barber saw me. She combed my hair in the part the wrong direction. And I saw it in the mirror and I was like, who is that person? Like, fix it. You know, she's like, oh, I thought it might look good this way. It's like, don't make me like that. You know, like, give it back. Emma got the middle part one time, which is trendy right now, I think. We looked at it for like, this is not you. We cannot let the barber do this to you. She went right back to the side thing, right? The other people make us us. That's how it works. And that's a good thing a lot of the time. I don't mean to run from that at all. But it leaves us with this question. Is there a core to who I am? Is there an unchanging piece of me that exists no matter what relationship I'm in? If I'm made by other people and how they view me, where do I get a sort of core identity, a sort of core to who I am? Our identities, if they're so heavily influenced by other people, are inherently unstable. Who we're around matters a ton. It changes everything. That was exactly what the people in Ephesus are wrestling with. These different types of relationships that were naming them and shaping them and forming them and calling them into who they were. I'll pull out this. You know, we've been in this text for a couple of weeks now talking about attributes of a leader. So I'm going to jump around to a few things that we haven't touched so far yet. But there are three different sort of relationships here where the believer in Christ at Ephesus would have had to move between and to discover some core to their identity, their relationship with people in the church, their relationship with people in the home, and their relationship with people in the world. How can I be the same person coherent part of my personality in all of these different places? It's a question that we have to wrestle with, and even maybe more so in a more intense way in the world of the iPhone and the ubiquitous camera, right? Because now our identities are far more inherently unstable because we live our lives before the face of so many more people. You now, your the Native Americans were right when they said that photography would steal your soul on some level, right? Because now your picture and the way you present yourself into the world is shaped by not the people immediately around you, your networks immediately around you, but all the people from the past in your life and the entirety of the world in the present. Whatever machine it is that you're logging this into, it's hard, man. And so our identities, of course, become inherently more unstable. Who are we at our core when so many different people and relationships are naming us? We need something stable to name us. We need a presence with which we can be in relationship to that will never leave us, that will never fail us, that will always be with us. And that's exactly the sort of presence that Paul describes. He says this: you want an inherently stable identity and core? You have to root who you're being named by in something that transcends every power on earth and even death itself. You have this stable identity. Why? Because you, both in you and among you, are the household of God. The household of God. See what that means? His presence, he is always with you and in you and among you. And he does not change, and he does not leave you, and he does not forsake you. His face smiles upon you unchangingly. Our identities can be stable even though we're named by other people, because the one who names us is stable. Jesus himself. We're in the household of God. We're in his presence. And that presence ought to sort of inculcate in us an integrity in every other relationship in our life. One thing is always true, no matter what relationships you're in the church, in the home, or in the world, that God the Father dwells with you and smiles upon you. And you know that that is the core truth of your life. How does it shape us in these three different relationships? I'll be really brief. In the church, first, did you see it there in verse 1 and 2? Clearly, the context for these verses is in church structure and organization, this office of overseer. They must be simultaneously able to teach and respectable. In other words, they must have integrity. They must be able to put their money where their mouth is in the church. They have to preach and know and be able to teach the gospel of Jesus Christ and the good news of his salvation for the world. But they also have to be able to live it out. And there has to be an alignment and integration between those two different things. Nothing drives cynicism in an organization or a community more than a leadership which says it's about one thing and invites everybody to play by those rules and then is in actuality in it for some entirely different reason. All of a sudden, you've got implicit rules and explicit rules, and you never know which rules to play by in the community, right? And it's confusing. And so you get cynical about the official announcements or the words of the teacher when their life doesn't back it up. That's what makes it so confusing when churches fall apart because of leadership struggles, right? We want to defend the explicit rules, which were good ones. But inside, there was this other system brought on by lack of integrity on the part of both the members of the church and the leadership of it that makes everything fall apart. That makes everything fall apart. Cynicism is driven by a lack of integrity, a failure to live before the face of God in every single one of our relationships in the church. That doesn't mean that your leadership or you, yourself, in whatever spheres of authority you actually have to be perfect. You can be haggard, but you have to be here. I don't know if you followed any of the Ukraine-Russia stuff. I'm not making a comment on the politics of it at all. I will say this. One thing I've been really just sort of looking at the information and stories that are coming out of there, following along the narrative of Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, and how this guy sort of embodied a transformation amongst his community brought on as a result of his integrity. Do you remember? You remember some of these videos coming out early on during the invasion of Ukraine? It was, you know, all the Russians were massed against him, and they were spreading these rumors that Zelensky, the president, had fled. He was gone, you know. And so he puts out this video on Facebook, and basically all he says, he's not shaven. He obviously hasn't slept in a couple days, but he's standing in the central square of his city, and he says, "I am here, and he is here, and so and so is here. We're all here. We have not run. I don't need ammunition. I don't need a ride. I need ammunition. I'm staying here for the glory of Ukraine," right? And that integrity inspired 18,000 people to go pick up guns and defend their territory in a way that they never would have done before. Why? Because within the community of insiders, the leaders and those who had authority lived lives of integrity. This is what Paul is calling the church to. This. That in this community, you would both learn and know the truth and embody it. Walk it out. You can be haggard. You can be busted. But you have to be here. That ought to be the sort of community that we are, right? The sort of community that actually welcomes the integrity of honest confession, not just perfection, right? The sort of community that when people are showing up in honesty, we reward it and applaud it, even if the confessions are messy, right? Because that's what it means. What's the alternative? The alternative is to live as a community, not before the face of God, but before the face of man, in an attempt to keep the plastic mask on all the time. That's the only, those are the only two ways. And Jesus says, you want to be a different sort of people in the world? You start by living with integrity amongst yourselves. They must be respectable and able to teach. Both the leaders as icons of the, or sort of symbols of the new humanity, and also the people who are under them. Living before the face of God calls us to live with integrity in the church, but that's too easy, isn't it? Let's be honest. Anybody can live with integrity outside of your house. Anybody can do that. You know, you can keep it together for 18 hours a day, 16 hours a day. Paul calls us to something much deeper. He calls us to an integrity that doesn't just happen out in the community of believers, but also happens in the home. Did you see it? He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? When you read keeping his children submissive, you think authoritarian. You think shouting in an effort to make everybody conform. That's not how people ever conform. I've talked to you about big rats and little rats. I'm going to tell you again because we got new faces. In a study of the leader of rat packs, there were two different types of leaders, these big rats. They would win by these feats of strength, these battles or whatever. The rats that had the most power, the most authoritarian rats, shall we say, won all their fights and quickly assumed control of the pack of rats, right? But they didn't stay there long. Because if they won 100% of their fights, eventually all the other rats realized that there was no room for them in this pack. There was no room for them to eat. There was no room for them to mate. Their prospects were super limited. So you know what happened? All the little rats band together and eat the big rat. That's what happens when the big rat wins 100% of the time. Now, some of you, in whatever sphere of authority you have, maybe it's in your home, maybe it's at job or whatever else, wherever else you have the sphere of authority, you think that to bring the kingdom and to get your way is to win 100% of the time. Warning, little rats, you know, like, and we've seen this happen in families, right? In hyper-rigid, controlled environments where there's never any space to breathe and where the parents can never say, "I'm sorry, I messed up," when they don't have the integrity to admit that God's law and God's call on their life sits over them too, the little rats always eat the big rat. You know, they almost always do. You know, the study said this: big rats that win 80% of the time preside over really stable communities. What can we learn from this? I think the same thing that Paul is trying to teach us here. That authorities have to rule. They have to have authority. They have to have the strength to do and be what God calls them to be. They have to push God's truth out into the world. They have to. But they also have to be willing to die. They have to be willing to lose. The rats that took a loss 20% of the time ran the kingdom the longest. That's how you keep, quote, children submissive, both in our own homes and in the household of God. Not by being some authoritarian who's right all the time, but by firmly believing in the truth of God and not swaying from that, because you know that you as an authority live before the face of God and his opinion of you matters so much more than anything else, that you could not stop telling the truth about God and who he is in whatever sphere you have it. But if that's true, and you're telling the truth about God and yourself, you cannot help but be convicted by it as well. You're forced to live with integrity. I love how this section on leaders is stuck between two assertions of identity on Paul's part. Because Paul lives before the face of God, two things are true of him. In chapter 2, he says this. Well, you see it at the end, actually, of chapter 3. We are the pillar and buttress of the truth.
Yes. Obey.
Right? But you know what came first in chapter 2, right before all these instructions? This saying is trustworthy and full and worthy of true full acceptance, that Christ Jesus came to save sinners, of whom I am the foremost. Exercising our authority comes somewhere between pillar and buttress of the truth. I am the foremost of sinners, right here in the middle, in this house where you can't get away with any propaganda because people in there know you. They know the act. They're the most like God in this respect, that they are not fooled by the clothes you put on this morning to come to Christ the King on Sunday in the South. They're not fooled by it. They're not fooled. There are lots of reasons that children leave the faith. It's not just because of failures on the part of the parent. I want to make that clear as a qualifier here. All sorts of things happen, but this is the heart of a leader who loves well, that the people who know them the best can say, yes, they live before the face of God, cognizant both of his holiness and their own brokenness. So they live with integrity in the most intimate places. It's who they really are. It's the core identity at the heart of their being. So because we live before the face of God, we can live with integrity in the church. We can live with integrity in the home. Lastly, this, we can live with integrity in the world. Verse 7, it's tempting right now to say that it doesn't matter what the world thinks. It's just our job to hold fast to the truth. It doesn't matter what the world thinks. It totally matters what the world thinks. Paul says it right here. Your leaders must be well thought of, not by other Christians, but by outsiders. Huh. Interesting. Interesting. So that he may not fall into disgrace, into a snare of the devil. What does that mean? Does that mean we go chasing popularity? Does that mean that our leaders are popular because they acquiesce to the spirit of the age or the temptations of the world? That's not what that means at all. But it means that these leaders have earned the respect, not just of this community, because it can be easy to rally that sort of crowd as well. You know, you can preach to the choir and against the world, and as a result, get a decent sort of following, right? Maybe that's your temptation, to be that sort of person who solidifies around being against the world. No, that's not who we're called to be. We're called to be the sort of people who earned the respect of the world because of our integrity, because of the coherence of our identity, because no matter what the situation, we live before the face of God, cognizant of his holiness and our own brokenness. That's the sort of thing that makes converts. It's integrity, not popularity. It's knowing who we are and living it out, not brand management. Think of the Roman soldier when he saw Jesus with a sign over his head named King of the Jews, nailed to the cross. What did he say? A lot of the world shrugged their shoulders, divided up his clothes. The Roman soldier said this, almost to himself, "Surely this man is the Son of God." His conversion came not because Jesus managed his brand, not because he looked good, but because he lived faithfully and with integrity. That integrity makes others want to live before the face of God too. It frees the world from the rat race and the hamster wheel of human and socially constructed identity and gives us a core coherence that transcends time and space and even death itself. Because you live before the face of God and his smile reaches down to the grave on Easter and comes out of it again, you can live with integrity. You can love the whole time. I'll close with this one story. Bernadette was a rural French white girl with about an eighth grade education. She's a waitress. A neighboring soccer team came into town and she was out dancing and met Jean-Pierre Adams, a player for that team. He was tall. He was a good dancer. He had a great smile. He was also black. She fell in love immediately. She loved the way he danced and lit up the room. She loved how kind he was to her and polite. They started dating, but against the advice of Jean-Pierre, all of his friends were like, "She just wants to be with you because you're famous. She doesn't really love you." You know? But she believed in her heart that she did. Eventually, there was some conflict with her mom. After all, it was the 60s, and he was black and she was white. You can't really love him. But she did. She loved him when he was famous. She loved him when he was hated by her mom. And his career got better. You could believe that she loved him for his fame after a while because he kept getting better and better. Eventually, he played for the French national team something like 20 times. He became a big deal. But as all careers do, this one went on the wane. Time, age, distance, mileage caught up to him. He descended down the ladder, playing for worse and worse teams until finally a knee injury ended his career. They moved to a small town in the French countryside. Maybe now Bernadette leaves, but she doesn't. She loved him when he was famous. She loved him when her mom hated him. She loved him when he was not famous. They opened a little store, a country store, in a small town in the French countryside. He played with his kids and spent time in the store himself. She loved him during that time, too. She even loved him after she got the phone call one day. He'd gone in for a knee operation, a little one on the back of his knee, so that he could run around and play with the kids a little more in the shop. He'd just gone in for a minor thing. She got the phone call from the hospital saying, "Come in. Something's happened." She loved him when he was brain dead because he hadn't gotten enough oxygen. She stayed in the hospital by his side for a couple of months while the doctors tried everything they could to wake him up. She loved him then too, advocating for him with the care team. Eventually, they said, "There is nothing more that we can do. You should go home about your life. We'll keep him hooked up here." She couldn't bear it. So she loved him when he was famous. She loved him when he was hated by her mom. She loved him when he wasn't famous. She loved him when he was in the hospital. And she loved him when she took him home. She had to teach his neck muscles to feed. She spent hours every day cooking and mashing up meals and massaging his neck muscles so that he would swallow. He couldn't move at all. He was in a coma. His eyes were open, but unfocused. She did 5 meals a day like this, always talking and singing to him, asking what he thought of her cooking. He never responded. She loved him then. She loved him when all the newspapers went away, when all the attention disappeared, when the friends stopped visiting, when the old teammates stopped visiting. She loved him even then. She loved him for 40 years. She loved him till he died, rotating his body to keep from getting bed sores and feeding him, always feeding him, one meal blending into another. At the end of it, the team that he played for hosted a reception for Jean-Pierre Adams. And they brought his wife to the thing. And the newspaper reporters all ran over to the famous players from the old days who were there. And one of them pointed to Bernadette, rural French girl with an eighth grade education, and said, "You shouldn't be interviewing me." you should be interviewing her, because she loved him the whole time. When the reporter asked her why she did it, she said, "I've kept my vows, I've kept my promise till the very end." It's a powerful love in every context. We need leaders and Christians who are not as good at brand management as they are at changing bedclothes and avoiding bed sores and feeding people five times a day, changing the diapers of the church until such a time as she wakes up again. We need people who live before the face of God with integrity, regardless of circumstances. Will you pray with me? Our Heavenly Father, will you help us to be people who are aware and conscious of your holiness and our need for you? Will you help us to live before your face? Will you name us more than anything else? Will you guide us? Will you make us conscious of your presence with us, smiling upon us? Would you help us live for you? We ask in your Son, Jesus' name.